This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 148th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are looking at Detective Comics 465 from DC Comics, cover dated November 1976. But first, a little feedback. Our last episode was dedicated to the late Zoom Yukinori, and James Williams wrote in about that. I'm still in shock that Zoom passed away. As a fellow disabled person, I felt a special bond with Zoom. No matter how hard things got, Zoom was always so joyful on his podcasts. I've downloaded every Fire and Water Podcast Network episode that Zoom produced or guested on, and I'm re-listening to them. Listening is so bittersweet, but I'm thankful that he left us with so many hours of him sharing his joy with us. Very well said, James. Very well said. After listening, TARDIS Rider posted a picture of their beautiful kitty cat with this note: I thought the latest episode was pretty good, but Sophie thinks it's perfect. And Karen from Between the Pages wrote in, by coincidence: fun episode about a fun comic. Catwoman is one of my favorite characters. And I have one more coincidence for you. This morning's post of Between the Pages was an adorable Bronze Age Catwoman cake. And I checked the link, and it was definitely the same costume from that issue. Thanks for sharing that, Karen. Billy D commented, "Oh, that zany Catwoman. Bruce is too interested in her for his own good sometimes." And a shout-out to Podcasting's Michael Bailey for binging a bunch of our network episodes recently one morning when he had to be in at work at 6 a.m., no less. So it was a pleasure to keep you company, buddy. He wrote in a few notes about some of what we've covered here the last few months. On the format of the show debate, I am not really all that bothered how much the comics cost you, if they cost you anything at all. I am here for the commentary, not the price. So if you want to include books you read on the DC Universe app or Hoopla or the like, then that's fine by me. I know some people named Shag or Stella get hung up on these things. But do you really need to listen to people that break the format of their own shows? Oh, yeah! Do you know who just took my side?
I am Michael Bailey.
That's right. Podcasting's Michael Bailey is on my side. Take that, losers. Okay, I may have gone too far there. Sorry. But back to Mike's email. Anyway, I liked your coverage of the Kirbyverse books quite a bit. I grabbed a copy of Captain Glory number 1 from a dollar box at a con last year and look forward to reading it now more than ever, because it sounds exactly like I thought it would be. I'm a 90s guy when it comes to comics, and that was my silver age of reading and collecting. And even though I didn't read these books at the time, I do remember the surge of Kirby love that hit around 93 and 94. The guys over at Image professed a lot of respect for the King, which I'm assuming made it cool for the people reading their comics to like the King as well. My personal feeling is that Jack's work always seemed to go down a little better when he had a writer to work with, but a part of me just loves how gonzo his solo work could be. It's a shame that the Kirbyverse didn't take off, but like you, I appreciate that the money went straight to him, and I'm a sucker for putting trading cards in comics. I tend to agree with you on some points there, Mike. Jack was usually better with a scripter, but also, I'm glad at least some of these crazy solo works exist. Mike also mentioned that it's a good thing that I took it out of the bag, actually. Those bags were not acid-free. And right now, comics are getting eaten because people wanted to retain their resale value. Or just didn't sell. It's a 50-50 shot. Anyway, that's all for now. Take care, my friend. And you take care as well, Michael. And Shag and Stella, you guys can take care too. That last episode received social media love from Chris Willett, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Ivan Chudley, Trevor Owen Williams, Mike Zomkowski, Andy Leyland, and Luke Giaconetti, both from the Two True Freaks podcast network, Derek William Crabb of the Fan Holes podcast, Chris from Professor Frenzy, It's a Show, Mike Morse, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Randy Watts, Old School Ross, Dr. Ange, Robert Ludwig, The Most Sane Man Among Us, Fan Film Fridays, and our listeners of the year, the Count and Countess of the Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. Thank you all. And that brings us to Detective Comics 465, which had a cover price of 25 cents, which means I got this book at exactly the correct cover price, which is exactly what happened last episode, too. The cover, by Ernie Chan and Tatiana Wood, shows Batman crashing through a skylight, busting in on a couple of bad guys holding weapons on Commissioner Gordon? Exclusive. The untold story of the best-kept secret in Gotham City. And in a little corner, we see a picture of a stretchy-necked detective, Extra, the elongated man. Now, this is definitely a dramatic cover, but you'd think at this point that bad guys would stop having their bad guy meetings in buildings with huge skylights. Bad guy contractors should know that by this point. The Best Kept Secret in Gotham City was written by David V. Reed, with art by Ernie Chan and Frank Giacoya. For clarification's sake, at this point, Chan was going by the name Ernie Chua. We start, like we said last episode, in this era, DC used that first page as another, like, intro-type page, sometimes replicating the cover, but sometimes not. In this one, we get three bad guys trying to remove the costume from Batman, only to find the suit empty. And we do get this dramatic narration. Ever since the avenging figure of the Batman first flashed in the sky over Gotham, the great enigma of his other identity has remained unsolved. To all those who wonder, how does he keep his mystery inviolate? We offer part of that answer in The Best Kept Secret in Gotham. We begin with a one-page prologue taking place some years ago, early in the evolution of the deep and enduring bond between Batman and Police Commissioner Gordon. Batman has something serious to discuss, which is the notion that the underworld might try to strike at Batman by going through Gordon, knowing how strongly allied they are. Batman asserts that the bad guys are probably convinced that Gordon, and perhaps Gordon alone, knows who he really is. Should that ever happen, remember this. Resist for a while, then pretend to break. Tell them my real name is Neil Merrick, and that I'm in the real estate biz, and that you know nothing more. Time passed, but that secret has never been forgotten by either man. Then, on a recent afternoon, a man named Thomas Greer, a man in construction, enters Merrick's office and asks for an appointment. The receptionist, while pressing a silent alarm, says that she doesn't have any information about her boss. He seldom comes here and usually communicates by calling in. Simultaneously, at the penthouse apartment of Bruce Wayne, Master Bruce, the library cabinet. It's the Merrick alarm. Bruce and Alfred watch a recording of Greer's visit, and Bruce recognizes the voice. He calls the commissioner's office and learns that he went downtown on his own earlier in the day and can't be located currently. Alfred, the thing we feared all these years has happened. Commissioner Gordon has been kidnapped. At the bad guy's lair, Greer reports in, and they debate whether to kill Gordon right away. Once the cops know he's missing, they'll tear the town apart. Meanwhile, in a secret laboratory beneath the Wayne Foundation, Bruce takes the picture of Greer and develops a potential mugshot after removing... This is before Photoshop, kids, I'll have you know. Removes his facial hair and his glasses, etc. And then he does recognize the man. And then he goes to the boards. The boards. Batman's most covert link to his prime informants. People who never meet with him, people with resources, but people who owe the Batman. They're a well-chosen network of local neighborhood bulletin boards. And again, we mean literal, actual brick-and-mortar boards to post notices and business cards, etc. And he posts his coded message on a style of business card that only he uses. Wanted. Desk with drawer for ink press dryer. Oak preferred. Seller, call 347-6190. A coded message that the operatives can decipher into. Wanted. Starkey Kell. That night, a weak, elderly lady checks in on one of the bulletin boards, and a young tough runs up behind her to grab her bag. Another sad mugging victim in the big city. Except that this old lady is in fact Batman, and he whams that potential mugger into another line of work. He does see a coded reply message, tonight 11662 Northeast, informs the Batman where to go, and this is a pharmaceutical office. But before he can do anything to stop a potential theft that Kell is in charge of, Batman notices another gang on its way to pull the same job at the same location. He doesn't want this second gang to interrupt Starkey, because he needs to follow Starkey back to his hideout. So he ends up stopping a second robbery to make sure the first one succeeds. And as he finished taking out this second crew, Starkey's car pulls out, and Batman is able to follow it. As it pulls into a garage, Batman crashes through a big old window, similar to the cover scene. The full might of Batman is released, and in that small space, its force is cyclonic. "Where's Commissioner Gordon?" he yells at the big boss, and the big boss tells him. And down in the cellar, the Batman finds a door, and he hesitates. Until now, he had not dared think he might be too late. But as he lifts the bar and pushes open the door, he hears an old friend's voice. "Ah, Mr. Merrick, I've been expecting you." After saving Gordon, the two friends decide to keep the whole affair a secret, and they know that they'll have to come up with a different fake identity to protect the best-kept secret in Gotham City. But in the last small panel of the story, we see into the commissioner's thoughts. The best-kept secret in Gotham City? I wonder what the Batman would say if I told him who I think he really is. And it turned out I was right. The end. So like my buddy Trennis Magnus likes to ask, what did I think of this? I have to say that it's actually not much of a story in terms of the amount of stuff that happens. It only takes up 11 pages, too. But I was smiling the entire time I read this. I really enjoyed this. There are just some elements in here that I really like. We talked last time about the Batman and Sherlock Holmes comparison, and I love it when Batman veers that direction, especially in Detective Comics, where it's so fitting that he does so. So again, there are only 11 pages of story, 10 if you don't count that intro splash page. But even in that brief amount of page real estate, we get at least four, depending on how you count them, great Holmesian style moves. And like I said, they all made me smile. Like last episode, we get Batman dressing up, and again as a woman, but this time, the poor potential mugger gets completely beaten down, which I guess is one of the major risks of being a mugger in Gotham City. Any person, any age, any gender, probably any race, could in fact be Batman in disguise. I don't think I would take that risk if I were a mugger, which I'm not. But back to the point. I love any time Sherlock Holmes disguises himself. And I love any time Batman does so as well. And then we get the use of operatives and public forums for exchanging messages. I didn't check this, but I'm pretty sure this is the only time we get the boards. At least, I don't remember ever running across this technique in any other Batman story. Now, in Holmes' stories, this communication took place in the classified ads in the broadsheets. And I think this is sort of a logical extrapolation of that, a logical version, circa the mid-1970s. Now, this would be some kind of group chat or forum, but I do remember drugstores and grocery stores and places like that that had bulletin boards that you could put notifications of lost pets or yard sales, cards for sale, business cards, stuff like that. Now, these guys, of course, aren't exactly the Baker Street irregulars. These guys don't know each other. They don't hang out. But the notion that Batman would use, in this way, a group of people who owed him something, what a great idea. Now that Comic Book DB has gone away, I wasn't able to easily figure out how many Batman stories David V. Reed wrote, but my sense is it's not a ton. And I don't think ideas of his like this were really taken and run with by anyone else. But again, I loved it. And then we get the code. I love the presence of the code, which was based on skipping letters in the message, based on the first number in the phone number of the message. Very solid spycraft, at least based on the spy and thriller novels I've read. But it was also visual enough, they showed the message on the business card, that any reader could see it after it had been explained to them. Which, again, is a very nice bit of comic book storytelling. Writer and artists working together. And then, just the opening idea, the concept that Batman is rich enough to have a full-time cutout for this identity. A full-time employee whose only job is to sit in a fake office and wait and wait and wait for the day that someone walks into that office. I like that. Again, it seems like something possibly out of Holmes, but certainly out of John le Carré or Bond or some other spy, espionage type of story. And then the ending, the very ending, that very last panel, this tease that Gordon might know the secret identity. That's great. Again, I don't think it was followed up on. I don't know that we ever learned what his guess was. But that moment, peering into Gordon's thoughts, that really worked for me. Like I said, I was smiling right from the start, right up until that final moment. Thoroughly enjoyable story. Now, there is a larger comic book trope that is addressed in this story, but I'll talk about that after I cover the backup story, seeing as the topic is part of that story as well. And we'll get to that right after I play this promo. I don't want this episode to be too elongated. Man, that would be a bummer.
This year, in 2020, we will see DC Comics celebrating the 80th anniversary of Robin, and so will Terrence, Ryan, and myself here on the podcast.
Every other episode this year, well, as long as Rob can keep everything straight, will have us following Tim Drake in the 1990s/2000s DC timeline.
The following episode, we will be joined by a selection of special guests throughout 2020. The guests will be selecting their favorite Robin and a story that connects them to the character. It could be a comic, movie, animation. Hey, wait. So, like, could we be reading Red Hood and the Outlaws on this show?
Or Nightwing?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Whoa. Wait, so you're opening the door to not just Tim Drake, but any Robin?
Yeah.
So does that mean Rick Grayson?
Yeah, like the new 52 Helena Wayne, Robin of Earth 2, heck, even the pre-crisis Robin of Earth 2? Or, dare I even say, Damian?
Batman Forever?
1950s detective in Batman stories?
Batman 66 episode?
Batgirl Stephanie Brown?
Teen Titans Robin with Wolfman and Perez? Jeff Johns and... oh no. No. Scott Lobdell? No!
Okay, while I give my co-hosts a minute or so to digest all of this information, you can find our show, Robin Everyone Loves the Drake Comic Podcast, through the BatmanUniverse.net podcasting network. Also available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you traditionally listen to your podcasts from. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think Terrence might need a bottle of water. Or maybe a paper bag.
No! New 52!
It's gonna be okay, Terrence. It's gonna be okay!
Change of Tim Drake's origin.
Don't worry, Terrence.
Crazy Red Robin costume.
It's gonna be okay. Maybe it won't happen.
And we're back. The Elongated Plague was written by the Answer Man, Bob Rozakis, with art by Ernie Chua and Terry Austin. We start in Star City, the day of the StarCon comic book convention, which has invited Ralph Dibny, the world-famous Elongated Man, as their guest of honor. This, despite the fact that both Black Canary and Green Arrow live in Star City. As a matter of fact, the newspaper headline proclaims that Black Canary just put the calculator in jail, which happened in the backup story of last issue. And then the Dibnys run into the calculator right there on the street, and he is holding up the newspaper. And then he shoots light beams at Ralph, and Ralph stretches around to pick up the newspaper and drop it on top of the calculator's head, cutting off his eye beams. It turns out that this guy is just cosplaying for the con, and ends up asking Ralph for an autograph. And then, once Ralph heads into the con, it turns out that there was another con, because he's actually not a cosplayer. This was, in fact, the calculator. He just broke himself out of prison, and it's so recent that the newspaper hasn't reported it yet. I know what you're thinking, but wasn't it on everyone's Twitter? Just get off my lawn! Ralph walks into StarCon, and everybody around him starts stretching, unable to hold themselves together. Shockwaves ripple through the stretched-out crowd, followed by roars of laughter. See, they think it's all a stunt. Now turn it off, they request. But Ralph didn't cause this, and he can't turn it off. And then a balding, portly Superman cosplayer threatens to beat the rubber bands out of Ralph faster than a speeding bullet. Calculator observes all of this, gloating that he's stolen Elongated Man's fame and made his fans gang up on him. This, my friends, is cancel culture circa 1976. Then, from beneath what looks like a pile of costumed spaghetti, Ralph grabs the calculator's leg and stretches it all out of proportion. And he super stretches the villain's nose. And now to wrap this up, I'm going to squeeze the truth out of you. Punch out the end of this stretching sickness now, calculator, or I'll punch you out. And a couple of taps on the villain's chest keypad, and there, everything's back to normal. And then Ralph punches out the calculator and sends him back to prison. He wins the Bravest Hero in Star City Award at the con, while in the last panel, Calculator plots his next issue attack on Green Arrow. The end. So what did I think of this one? First, I haven't run across the Calculator a lot, so I have no idea if this power is within his standard repertoire. Can he steal someone's power from a distance and then, I guess, instantly aerosolize that power and give it to others? And then just cancel those powers with a few keystrokes? Because that doesn't make any sense at all. But it's a story at a con with cosplayers before cosplayers were cool, and that's worth noting. And Ralph does use the threat of consequences and then the delivering of consequences to win the day, and that works for me. Overall, it's not bad, but it's also not memorable in any way. There's not a lot you can do in six pages, but Razakis does what he can, and should mention that the stretchy-based art is also quite good, and that, of course, is important as an element in an elongated man story. And the relationship between Ralph and Sue works here. Their relationship, it just works. And even though Sue disappears in the middle of that story, she does have a role at the end that's important. And she delivers a funny line. So again, all of that worked. So I really don't have much more to say about the story itself. But I do want to spend a few minutes here at the end talking briefly about the common element of these two stories. And that is the topic of dual identities, which, of course, is a standard trope of comic books from their very beginnings. So we have the first story, which revolves around the fake secret identity that only Batman and Gordon know. And then the second story works because Ralph Dibny is known publicly as the Elongated Man. So his stories always involve that topic. And to be honest, his stories always exist as a counterpart to that standard trope, to the idea that heroes have to have identities hidden from the public to protect their loved ones. And the Dibnys say to that, no, that doesn't have to be true. And before you jump on me about identity crisis, let's remember that Sue wasn't killed by a crazed member of the public, but by a crazed member of the superhero community. So to me, that point still stands, that public identities don't have to make loved ones more endangered. Also, let me say that I'm not referring obliquely or directly to the 2020 DC Comics where Superman is revealing that he is Clark Kent. You may have noticed the last decade or so, but Superman fans can be kind of passionate and have, let's go with, strong opinions. So I'm not talking about that situation in particular. I'm talking about the concept in general. And I'm actually going to express my opinions pretty briefly here. This is a topic, the topic of private identities or secret identities. It has been on the list for Shortbox Showcase for a really long time. And hopefully we'll get to it. Shortbox Showcase was inspired, as many of you know, somewhat by the Hey Kids Comics podcast with Andy and his son Michael Leyland. And at this point, Michael and Andrew are on about the schedule of 2 episodes per year. And I've talked to Em about this. And between us, jointly, our priority for 2020 is going to be Dorkness to Light. So Shortbox may end up on that similar Hey Kids Comics once or twice a year schedule. But there is still a chance that we're going to get to that episode eventually and have a long, more involved discussion about private identities, secret identities. So here I'm just going to be brief. And I don't think that a superhero needs a secret identity. I certainly don't think that every superhero needs one. And I definitely don't think that new characters, newly created 21st century characters, need secret identities. I do think that the points that are raised about modern technology and facial recognition software and tracking and DNA would make a secret identity really difficult to maintain in the real world. It is really, really hard to be really, really off the grid. Now, of course, you then have to say that if we had powered beings of some kind, whether that came from radiation or lightning or chemicals, or if a character came from some distant alien world, our laws and our technology and police processes would have to change so dramatically that that world and our current world would be so fundamentally different that comparisons would be pointless. So saying that, that's not how it works in regards to trials and police. For example, that every person needs to have a social security number in the United States, that you can't testify in court in a mask, you know, things like that. To have that complaint, which I actually think that complaint holds some water, I do think it's legit, but that complaint would actually not be valid in a world of those powers, because, again, our world would no longer resemble that world. But other things like walking around in a mask, how exactly would that be legal? Again, sorry, I am getting a little lost in the weeds here, and I do hope that M and I can do that episode about identities, and I'll talk lots and lots and lots more about my feelings there, and have someone much smarter on the show to express their opinions as well. So let me sum up. Heroes have had secret identities for longer than there have been comic books. And I'm not saying that we have to upend the trope, never use it again. What I'm saying is that characters like the Elongated Man, characters with a public identity, are really important elements in the world of superheroes. What I'm saying is, let's examine the trope on a case-by-case basis and ask if this particular hero needs a secret identity or not. And yes, this thought-provoking aspect of the two stories in this issue will definitely impact my verdict. The verdict on Detective Comics 465. This is a very under-read issue, I believe. I saw no evidence that it's ever been reprinted. And I'm not saying it deserves to be in a best-of collection or anything like that. It didn't deserve to be in Best of the 70s. It might not deserve to be in the Best of 1976. But I'm saying I really liked it. The lead story very much spoke to me, but I acknowledge that it might not work for everyone. But between that lead story and the fun backup at a comic book convention, this is a definite quarter bin steal. It's like a little piece of Dark Knight history that's been overlooked. That wraps up our coverage of Detective Comics 465, bringing episode 148 to a close. Next time, because it's an episode number that ends in 9, we are revisiting our number 9 series of episodes by looking at Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 5. From Marvel Comics, of course, cover dated February 1995. That issue reprints the triple-sized Fantastic Four 236, featuring a certain Latverian leader, as well as Marvel 2-in-150 and Incredible Hulk 318. It'll be an all John Byrne episode. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or this episode, secret identities, Batman in the 1970s, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.